Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's session is entitled Understanding Depression and Cognitive Dysfunction After TM, ADEM, or NMO. My name is Roberta Peche, and I am the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. Sam Huge from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, TM and NMO Center, will be moderating our podcast today. A few housekeeping pieces before we start. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org, and it can also be downloaded via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis.
Great. Thanks, Roberta. The 2015 TMA Ask the Expert podcast series is made possible through the generous support of Chugai Pharmaceutical Company. Chugai Pharmaceuticals is conducting clinical studies to create original and innovative drugs, both in the United States and overseas, to address unmet medical needs and neurological disorders where the level of pharmaceutical contribution and satisfaction concerning patient treatment remains low. We are thrilled to be joined today by Dr. Lana Harder and Dr. Adam Kaplan as experts on today's podcast. Dr. Harder serves as a clinical neuropsychologist at Children's Medical Center Dallas and as assistant professor of psychiatry and neurology and neurotherapeutics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She is board certified in clinical neuropsychology and specializes in the neuropsychological evaluation of pediatric patients with disorders of the central nervous system. Dr. Harder's research interests include cognitive and psychosocial outcomes for pediatric demyelinating diseases. Dr. Kaplan is the principal psychiatric consultant to the Johns Hopkins Multiple Sclerosis and Transverse Myelitis Centers of Excellence. He is a Johns Hopkins trained neuropsychiatrist who runs the MS&TM Neuropsychiatric Consultation Clinic and does research on the biological basis of mood disorders and cognitive impairment in central nervous system autoimmune disorders. He also investigates novel therapies for patients suffering from these diseases. He works at Johns Hopkins to develop and improve technological innovations to enhance psychiatric care and decrease stigma surrounding mental illness. So to start us out today, I'm going to throw it over to Dr. Harder. If you could please introduce what we know currently about cognitive dysfunction in these neuroimmune diseases of the central nervous system.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. And first, I want to start by thanking you guys, Sam and Roberta, as well as the TMA for having me today. I am, as we've heard, really starting to focus on this area in my research. This has become my primary focus over the years. And I have to say, I was a little bit surprised when I learned that our patients with these primary, you know, spinal cord conditions, TM, were having problems in school, specifically related to academic performance. Now, this constituted about a third of the patients that we saw. It was a small cohort that we were able to look at. So I want to emphasize that not everyone experiences cognitive problems in the context of TM, but we do know that there is a subset of these individuals. What I found out was that our pediatric patients with TM were experiencing a similar rate of academic difficulties to our patients with pediatric MS, and this surprised me because, as we know, with multiple sclerosis, there's obvious brain-based pathology, and so it sort of made sense to us that they may struggle in school. So this led us down the road of exploring cognitive functioning and transverse myelitis a bit more, and what we ended up finding was that there was a higher rate than expected of cognitive issues in the areas of attention, memory, these areas that are really important for learning and classroom performance. So we did publish a paper on that and have contributed to the knowledge that is out there. But we feel like we're really at the beginning of understanding why this is the case. And I think we're going to get to talk about that much more throughout this podcast. But it's kind of a general introduction. We are at the point where we're trying to explore what some of these underlying mechanisms may be for cognitive difficulties in the context of transverse myelitis.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Harder. Dr. Kaplan, there's also a question about depression and other mood-related issues with these demyelinating diseases and transverse myelitis. And could you give us an overview of the mood and depression aspect of the disease process?
Sure, I'm happy to. And again, I would echo Dr. Harder's thank you to the TMA and to all the people who are involved in this call today, because, you know, if we talk and there's nobody there, then it's very boring. So I look forward to having a chance also to hear from people what their experiences are like. But let me tell you, basically with transverse myelitis, and now it turns out that neuromyelitis optica is very similar in these respects, that we're finding similar rates of depression and cognitive impairment, in fact, that Dr. Harder had demonstrated in TM patients in NMO. So this is probably generalizable to these CNS autoimmune diseases. But essentially, I got involved back when Chitra Krishnan and Doug Kerr were running the transverse myelitis clinic at Johns Hopkins, and they had noticed that there was a very high rate of depression. So essentially, there's three main issues that I like people to understand about the depression that comes with these CNS autoimmune diseases. And again, we know most about MS just because it's 10 times or 20 times more common than the other disorders that we're talking about, NMO, ADEM, and TM. But essentially, the kind of depression that comes with TM, for instance, and NMO, as well as MS, is not, gee, you'd be depressed too if you had this disorder. It is actually a clinical condition that is, and we have evidence for this, the result of activation of the immune system within the vicinity of the brain. So, again, remember that in all of these conditions, one of the diagnostic characteristics is to be able to draw off cerebrospinal fluid and demonstrate that in the CSF that bathes the brain and spinal cord, there are very high levels, elevated levels of these messengers, immune system messengers, demonstrating that the entire brain and spinal cord are being bathed by this inflammatory bouillabaisse, if you will, by this inflammatory mix. And so it turns out that the depression, for which I mean clinical depression, is the result of having this inflammation going on in the brain. And it's actually during periods of attack that it tends to set off these depressions. But it's important to realize that it has an important aspect to the outcome. First of all, it's important to realize that depression is one of the leading causes of death, if unrecognized, because suicide is one of the cardinal, having suicidal thoughts is one of the cardinal symptoms. So in MS, suicide is the third leading cause of death across the lifespan, and 30% of people with MS will have thoughts of killing themselves. So it is important to realize that if someone has those thoughts, that is an emergency and requires prompt attention. But essentially, the symptoms of depression are trouble with sleeping, loss of interest, feelings of guilt or worthlessness, low energy, low mood, concentration problems, appetite changes, sort of not being your normal bubbly self, and thoughts of death. You have to have five of those nine symptoms in order to make the diagnosis, at least one of which must be decreased interest or decreased mood. And the important thing to realize is, again, this does not correlate with physical disability. In fact, those people who have depression and have very little or invisible disability, where it is above the neck disability, are often extremely in difficult positions because no one appreciates their level of distress. And so it has important functional implications. But the last thing that I just, it's very important to understand, is that it's treatable. So if you miss it, it can have devastating consequences, but it is treatable. Didn't have to be the case, but it turns out that the depression of TM, NMO, ADEM does respond to the antidepressants that we use for general depression. And what's even more interesting recently, there has been data to suggest that many of the treatments, if not most of them, that we use for depression turn out to be either neuroprotective or anti-inflammatory. So that's a very exciting discovery, is not only is These autoimmune diseases cause depression. Depression worsens these autoimmune diseases and has bad outcomes, but that if you treat them, the treatments end up being beneficial to both the depression and often to either directly or indirectly to the autoimmune disease itself. So that's a lot to digest, but I thought I'd try to get sort of the 34,000-foot view out.
Well, great. We appreciate that. So we're going to go ahead and dive straight into the more pointed questions that have been asked by the community. I'm going to throw the first one over to you, Dr. Harder. Why is there cognitive dysfunction when brain lesions aren't present? Is dysfunction brought on by the disease or peripheral conditions like depression, no longer working, pain, et cetera?
This is a fantastic question, and the question that we are trying to answer here at UT Southwestern and by working with our colleagues around the country. Cognitive dysfunction we have observed in transverse myelitis. There's also literature to show this in NMO, as Dr. Kaplan mentioned. And so sort of getting a sense of why that is what is ahead of us. As you all know, in the TMA community, we've had an exciting opportunity to partner with Consano, which is a nonprofit crowdfunding platform for medical research, and have raised funds to study this question. We are intending to use brain imaging to understand cognitive dysfunction in TM. And so we will be launching a pilot study here in the next few months that will actually get to look into the brains of our pediatric patients with TM to see if we can understand more about what might be going on in the brain. And so we'll be using these brain imaging techniques that are not routinely performed as part of the standard clinical care to give us a better idea about things like the white matter integrity, the brain volumes. There are lots of different things. I'm fortunate to have a great team of neuroradiologists here that are going to be working with us on that. So we hope that from that study we're going to learn more about what may specifically be going on in the brain. There was a really great point in that question about could this also relate to other things that are going on for individuals with transverse myelitis or NMO. In our study looking at cognitive functioning in pediatric TM, we looked very carefully at different variables. We looked at level of depression and did that seem to relate to cognitive problems. We looked at medication use to see if that related. We also looked at fatigue. And what we saw in our kind of qualitative review of our data was that for this particular cohort, it did not seem to be depression or medication, but we did see that fatigue, there was a big overlap in poor cognitive performance and fatigue symptoms. So that's also another opportunity for us to explore as we get larger numbers in our samples and can look at that in a more in-depth way. Like Dr. Kaplan mentioned, when we treat something like depression, we can also see positive outcomes, for managing the disease itself and in other areas. And I will say from my research across these demyelinating diseases, I am appreciating that these symptoms that are complex and multifaceted, these symptoms are interacting. And we think if we can target and prioritize a symptom, for example, like sleep problems and fatigue, that we would then see improvements in areas like cognitive functioning, mood, and just overall quality of life. So this is a great question that is posed and one that we are working very hard to answer on this end here.
Yeah, as a follow-up to that question, there's a question here. How would I know if the cognitive problems I'm experiencing, like poor memory, difficulty concentrating, and difficulty following complex arguments, are the result of the acute TM that I had years ago or caused by something else? So basically, how do we flesh out what could be cognitive impairment that's based on the TM attack versus other things going on?
Sure. This is a really important question, and neuropsychologists are asked all the time to answer questions such as these. And by undergoing that type of evaluation, a neuropsychologist would be well positioned to take a careful history. We even have measurements that can help us estimate abilities prior to any insult to the nervous system. So there are lots of ways to sort of, start to approach that. I would say, looking back historically, so prior to TM, to think about how cognitive functioning was back then, and then looking at when did the problems begin. So right after TM, was it a little bit longer down the road, and did that seem to coincide with any other major life events or changes in the individual? But, these, again, are the things that neuropsychologists are helping to answer when they work with a patient individually. And I would add, even if we aren't able to definitively ever answer that question, what we can say is that now that we know and we've documented that cognitive problems may exist in the context of TM. We have a great case for, having our TM patients evaluated or at the very least screened for these type of difficulties. But regardless of the specific, reason or cause of cognitive problems, we have really great tools and techniques that we can use to address the specific concern. So if the individual undergoes that evaluation, coming from, that process, we can create very tailored recommendations for how to address the problems that the individual is experiencing.
Yeah, and so now, so you have a patient who has transverse myelitis, say, and you fleshed out what kind of cognitive difficulties might exist, and then you give recommendations on what to do. What can a patient do to improve their chances of recovering cognitive ability following a TM attack?
Sure. So what we know about cognitive rehabilitation in general is, remaining cognitively active, engaging in things maybe you did before, if it's reading or problem solving or, the things that we do for work. Our brain is constantly evolving and changing in response to our experiences and to the things that we're doing. So that's really the good news. We have different approaches that we may take to addressing someone's cognitive impairment. There's a restorative approach where we have kind of formalized activities and exercises that a person practices over and over to, reinforce or strengthen a certain cognitive function, maybe memory. But more often than not in my setting, we are recommending what we call compensatory strategies. So if we know that, an individual is having problems remembering to do something like take medication or keeping track of schedules for therapy, things like that, we may suggest using some sort of cueing strategy. Lots of folks use their smartphones to set reminders. So those would be some examples of how we may target an area and really tailor a recommendation for that individual.
Great. I'm going to move over to Dr. Kaplan and ask some questions that were posed about depression and TM. And so is there anything about TM-induced depression that distinguishes it from non-TM-induced depression?
So that's a great question. Before I launch into that, Sam, if you'll indulge me, I just wanted to throw out just a couple of things that we've been looking at in MS and cognitive impairment, just because it might be the future of treatments for TM and NMO as well. So just the two things are that I wanted to mention that Kristen Ron, who is a collaborator with our group here at Hopkins, looked into the brains of patients with MS who had cognitive impairment using the same magnet that Dr. Harder was sort of suggesting that's used for MRIs, but then looked instead of looking at the structures in the brain, looked at the chemistry of the brain, and she showed that there was a particular neuropeptide in the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that forms new memory, that was low in patients with MS. And there is no drug that can treat that in people, so she moved to an animal model of MS, and when she raised the level of this peptide called N-acetylaspartoglutamate, which no one's heard of because no one really knows what it does in the brain, and we were the one of the first groups to show its role, certainly the first group in MS to show its role in cognition. When she raised the level of that peptide in the brain, those in the animal model of MS, the mice were able to sort of run through mazes as well as mice that didn't have the animal model of MS. So that's something coming in the future. And then the only other sort of future thing for which there isn't good evidence, and so, but just one of the projects we're working on is that it's known in, again, a different condition, Alzheimer's disease, that people's subjective belief that their life has purpose or meaning, and this actually comes from Viktor Frankl and some of his early work, the belief that your life has meaning and purpose correlates with a, you know, 2.5-fold lower rate of progressing to Alzheimer's disease in those people who have a high risk of Alzheimer's disease to begin with when followed prospectively, meaning you follow them, measure their levels, and then follow them over 5 years. Also, 70% less likely to have strokes in people who have high purpose in life scores. So again, I think it's very important that exactly as Dr. Harder said, to, you know, exercise and use your cognitive reserves and build up your cognitive abilities, also to remember that finding things to devote your life to that gives you meaning, that rewards you in that way, may in fact be something that at least we're doing research on now to see if it's important. So I just wanted to add that. But to get back to your question about the depression, again, the depression that comes with TM, for example, it often has the same symptoms that I discussed before. However, there are certain characteristics that we tend to see very commonly in the depression of TM, which is instead of sadness, we often see irritability. And it seems almost universal that people have trouble with sleep. It's rarely people sort of sleeping all the time. Well, not rarely, but less commonly people sort of sleeping all the time or having a hard time getting up and getting going. Their get up and go has gotten up and gone. But often it's trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking up early in the morning. And that, of course, contributes to the fatigue and the cognitive impairment that Dr. Harder was mentioning.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you for explaining that. And feel free to Dr. Harder jump in if you have any anything to add with in terms of the questions about depression as well. And so another question from the community was kind of another comparator question: do people with a spinal cord injury that's caused by trauma have the kinds of problems with depression and cognitive deficits that TM patients? Have you seen that at all, Dr. Kaplan?
So it's interesting because it's a great question and one that we had thought originally to use this group of people who have traumatic spinal cord injury as a control group for our patients with TM. The reason why it's difficult is it's sort of comparing apples and oranges. People who tend to get spinal cord injury tend to be daredevils, people who are skydiving, you know, jumping up to, you know, on top of basketball hoops and falling over and, you know, really adventuresome, normally adventuresome young or older men that get into trouble with spinal cord injuries. So it's a different sort of baseline that people are starting from. Having said that, it is the case that although people with spinal cord injuries can certainly get demoralized and sometimes overwhelmed in their coping strategies, they don't have the kind of clinical depression, the kind of depression that often, when it's severe, requires medication and talk therapy. and exercise and sort of a host of things in order to get well, that just sort of coaching them isn't sufficient when it's a clinical depression. So that's been my experience. I don't know, Dr. Harder, if you wanted to weigh in there.
Yeah, that's a great point you're making. I would add to that, you know, oftentimes there is a co-occurring brain injury when there's been, let's say, a traumatic spinal cord injury. And so that makes it very difficult also to sort of compare, because there may be, you know, an associated brain injury that's then leading to problems with cognition and things of that nature. So it can be a very complicated to compare those groups, I would say.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Thank you for bringing that up.
Another great question that was asked, is there any evidence that stress, anxiety, and depression may predispose a person to autoimmune attack on the central nervous system? So basically, can stress be a causative factor to autoimmune disease, specifically in the central nervous system?
Well, that's a very timely question, I'm going to jump right in there, because this is an area that we're very interested in and actively pursuing. So what I can tell you is that another group has published fairly recently that patients with MS, if they were depressed within 10 years prior to the onset of their MS, the depression doubled their risk of getting MS. So it turns out that not only does MS cause a depression through the effects of inflammation on the brain, and this is presumably applicable to TM and NMO as Dr. Harder and I have been suggesting, but that that having a chronic anxiety or chronic depression both have been correlated with increased risk of developing these autoimmune diseases. And our group is not published yet, so I'll have to kill anybody who talks about this. I'm just kidding. But we found the same thing with depression, increasing the risk dramatically of people developing rheumatoid arthritis. So this seems to be a general effect. And although we don't have data in humans for this, the model that we're working with that makes a lot of sense to me anyway is that it turns out the stress hormone of the body is cortisol. Well, cortisol is not just stress, but it turns out that cortisol is the same drug that the body makes as we deliver to people as prednisone or solumedrol, methylprednisolone, etc. It's a steroid. So it turns out the stress hormone is a steroid that is the emergency brake of the immune system. So not with acute stress. So don't try to say to your loved ones, don't yell at me because I heard on the TMA podcast that if you yell at me, my TM is going to get worse or my NMO is going to get worse. That's not true. But with chronic unrelenting stress, the kind that comes with a clinical depression, or, you know, there are other causes of chronic stress, that basically elevates the cortisol levels persistently, and that elevation persistently basically means you're riding the emergency brake and you wear it out, so that then when you get a viral infection or something else happens, you no longer have the brakes of the immune system, which we're now testing to see if this accounts for the phenomenon that we have very good data that says this kind of chronic stress is a risk factor for developing these autoimmune diseases.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And as a follow-up to that question, I think you touched on this earlier in your overview. Is there evidence that the treatment of stress, anxiety, and depression, whether it be through therapy or pharmacologically, can help prevent recurrence of autoimmune attack in the central nervous system?
So, again, it's easy to go to MS because most of the studies have been done in a disease that's much more common, as I say, tenfold or more common than TM or the like. There was a study about 2 years ago by Moore and colleagues out of Northwestern where they did show, because it had been known, and I'm glad for the follow-up, because it had been known that chronic stress worsens MS. and worsens the number of lesions you get and the attacks you get. And so they actually taught people stress relaxation exercises and the like and showed that it improved the clinical course of the MS. So there is data to say that treating the stress helps. Unfortunately, and this is what everybody with these chronic conditions knows, is that what they also found is that just like rehabilitation of all kinds, you have to maintain it. The moment you stop exercising, stretching, moving your limbs, and the moment you stop your stress reduction exercises, you go right back to where you were in terms of your risks.
Very interesting. Dr. Harder, do you have anything to add to that?
I think I saw the same study. I think Dr. Kaplan did a great summary, and in my clinical experience, I certainly do notice the chronic stress that some of our patients have in their histories, and this is also an area of interest for our research group as well.
Mm. Next question. Is that are TM-induced cognitive deficits likely to improve over time if the patient goes without a recurrence of disease? And is this a kind of damage that heals over time? Dr. Harder, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, I'd love to. That's an excellent question, and again, one that we're trying to answer here. So this is really a question about kind of longitudinal functioning. How do our TM patients look across time? So we are in the process of collecting that data. We don't have any clear answers to give you at this time, unfortunately. I would say stay tuned for that answer from the research perspective. And in terms of, on an individual basis, we really do recommend for those who have cognitive dysfunction and with this history of TM or NMO, we really do recommend working closely with a neuropsychologist who can evaluate cognitive functioning over time. So while we may be able to eventually one day describe this in the cohort that we are studying, I think it's really most important for individuals that they are learning about their own cognitive functioning over time. The nice thing about our evaluations and our serial evaluations is that we can really track those functions from one evaluation to the next. So very often in my clinic, I'll evaluate our patients with TM and NMO about once a year or once every 2 years, just to make sure that as they grow and change and as medical factors change, that we are tracking those things very closely. And we realize that our patients in some ways, are really moving targets because, number one, they're developing. Children are changing rapidly. The brains of children develop rapidly. But also we know that the disease process, particularly in the case of a chronic disease, can bring about new challenges. So as neuropsychologists, we are uniquely positioned to be there to measure those changes, but to importantly describe the need for intervention based on, a given period in time or grade level that the child is at or at a given age or life stage. So I think it's very important for individuals to be able to track that by working with their providers.
Mm. Yes, that's important. Dr. Kaplan, do you have anything to add about the cognitive improvement of individuals over time?
Nope. I think Dr. Harder covered all the bases.
Great. There is a question that I think was touched on earlier in the podcast, asking about the correlation between TM-related depression and cognitive dysfunction, the severity of such, and correlation with the severity of physical deficits. And is there a correlation between the two? And if not, why are the variables independent? Dr. Kaplan, would you like to speak to that?
Sure. Well, let me start with the last part first. And again, it's a very important question because I think it shines the light on the true biological basis of the depression with TM, which is that it does not correlate, nor in MS, nor in NMO, does it correlate with the level of physical disability, whether you have a clinical depression. And in fact, what it correlates with in MS are periods of immune activation, when you're having attacks, even silent attacks, on the brain by the immune system. So, as I say, some of the patients that are in a really difficult position are the ones who are suffering from a clinical depression but have sort of invisible TM because they've had a dramatic recovery. They're in that third group that have recovered significantly virtually completely their neurologic function, but still have this ongoing depression. And again, it does not correlate. It's not GED depressed too, because it really is the effect of the immune system. What I can tell you is that from my experience with people who have cognitive impairment that comes from the depression, the good news is that when you treat the depression, the cognitive impairment gets better when it is due to the depression. When it's due to the autoimmune disease, then you have to, follow all of the excellent recommendations that Dr. Harder said. But sometimes it's hard to tell. And when someone's depressed and they come in, I say to them, look, I can't tell you whether your depression is 90% due to the TM or 10% due to the TM and 90% due to the depression, but I promise you, once we get your mood treated with the expectation that we'll get your mood all the way back to your old mood, the depression, effectively treated to remission, that we'll see what's left, and if there is cognitive impairment left, then we will send you, if we're lucky enough, to a superb neuropsychologist like Dr. Harder.
Yeah, and Dr. Harder, do you have any tidbits from your experience about the severity of physical deficit and cognitive dysfunction?
We haven't explored this systematically in our data, but I will kind of echo what Dr. Kaplan said. It's my impression that those things do not seem to correlate closely.
I think we're going to switch gears a little bit. There are a couple questions about medications and drugs that are prescribed to treat things like fatigue and depression and how that affects the people's day-to-day lives. And so I'm just going to read this as it was written from the community. I've tried both dextroamphetamine and Nuvigil to give me the focus and mental clarity I need to do my job. They each work for a few weeks, after which they still keep me awake, but don't give me the oomph I need. Then I stop taking the pill and crash hard for a while, during which I'm almost completely unproductive. When I take a stimulant, is it causing me to use reserves that I'll need to replenish later? Am I effectively borrowing energy from the future when I use one of these? Dr. Kaplan, can you speak to that?
I was really looking forward to hearing Dr. Harder speak.
either one.
I'm happy to speak to the fact that and I will leave the heavy lifting to Dr. Harder on this one, but I will say that it's not uncommon for people to have missed the underlying cause of the cognitive impairment and the fatigue if it's depression. And instead start focusing on the symptoms. And when you do that, you can get into trouble, which is a lot of times people, if it's depression, but they're having trouble sleeping, they can put on a benzodiazepine-like Ativan or Valium or, heaven forbid, Xanax, because it's so short-acting. And that makes them tired, and then they get put on stimulants during the day to try to wake them up, and then that affects their sleep. And so, again, if you treat it symptom by symptom, depression can really, you can get into trouble where you're treating the side effects of medicines. However, if this is not depression and it is cognitive impairment and someone has fatigue related to their cognitive impairment, then I'll listen to what Dr. Harder has to say.
Great. Well, whenever I'm working with someone trying to tease apart all of these different factors, one of the first places I start is with sleep and making sure that, the patient is able to achieve sleep onset and maintenance and just to have good sleep hygiene. So having, normal wake times that you go to bed at night, avoiding electronics before bed, which is really difficult to do in this day and age. But all of those things about sleep that really provide the foundation for our ability to function during the day. So I will routinely have my patients really start to sort those things out even before we get into a big formal battery of tests, because I really need patients to be at their best when I'm evaluating their cognitive function. So we know that sleep is a big piece, and then closely related to that, of course, is the daytime fatigue. I completely agree with Dr. Kaplan about really working hard at the beginning to determine where certain symptoms are coming from so that we're targeting the right area. And importantly, you know, prioritizing those areas. And again, I tend to go for sleep as one of the first most important things to kind of sort out, again, since it serves as a basis for what we're able to do and how we're able to function during the day. Kind of making a list of those priorities, taking them step by step, and at some point adding in that cognitive evaluation, but not until we've been able to address something like sleep and fatigue.
That's a really superb point. And it reminds me of one additional thing that happens here in Baltimore. I don't know if it happens down there in Texas, but one of the things that happens is sometimes people start self-medicating, and you know, the critical points that Dr. Harder made about sleep are completely undone by, for instance, alcohol use. Alcohol use at any time during the day will interfere with sleep, but particularly if you use alcohol to sleep at night, that really does upset with the refreshing aspects of it. And then here in Baltimore, you know, people are beginning to try to use medical marijuana, which is, you know, good for spasticity, but not so good for mood often, and it's also really bad for cognition. So something to keep in mind as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Another question that relates to prescription medication use and kind of bridges the gap with physical deficits that could be there too. Patient with TM who has depression and is being treated with an antidepressant may fear the sexual dysfunction side effects of the antidepressant medications, especially if they already have sexual dysfunction from the TM, and is there they might refuse the antidepressant medication. Is there any justification for that fear, or is it unwarranted?
So again, it's a great question, and I'm just going to jump in here real quick and say that first of all, the first thing that needs to be mentioned is that 80% of people with a clinical depression will have sexual side effects, often decreased interest or libido. If that's the elephant in the room, treating that will improve their sexual functioning. Having said that, particularly in the situation that the individual was raising, if they already have sexual side effects that predated the depression and is due to the TM or appears to be independently due to the TM, then there are a couple of things. One is to recognize that, yes, the SSRIs, all of the serotonin-selective antidepressants can affect sexual function. It's not 100%. It's 10% of people have trouble with erectile function, or women having some trouble with lubrication, and the like. So 25% of people on the serotonin antidepressants will have decreased libido. Again, that's small compared to the 80% if it's due to the depression, but still warrants consideration. So, however, if it is the case that someone, this is a big issue, then Wellbutrin, bupropion, is a medication that has absolutely no sexual side effect. In fact, for women in particular, there's data to suggest that it is even enhancing potentially at decreasing the latency to orgasm. I hope there aren't a lot of kids listening to this, but in any case, it is the case that it also counteracts the sexual side effects of the SSRIs. Wellbutrin certainly does often do it. And then the last thing to be aware of is that the sexual side effects, at least, yes, for both men and women, the sexual side effects of these antidepressants There is an antidote to it, and that is the Levitra, Cialis, Viagra. All of those drugs are the antidote to the sexual side effects that these medicines can cause. But it is, as the individual points out, it is a balancing act. But it's important, and the last thing to realize, that it's not a balancing act between sexual side effects and no sexual side effects. It's a balancing act between sexual side effects and not being able to function as a parent, not being able to get out of bed, having lost interest, not being able to work. Those are the side effects of the depression for which it's being treated, and that's the risk-benefit analysis that needs to be made.
That's a very good point, very good point. The last question that we have here I think is interesting. Does TM-related depression follow a seasonal pattern, and is there evidence that using a blue light helps with TM-related depression?
You know, it's interesting. Dr. Harder, I know that your group has been looking at blue lights and the like. Would you like to jump in? I don't want to monopolize the time here.
Actually, that could be the case on the adult side. In the pediatric setting, we have not looked at that. So I was very anxious to hear your answer to this question.
Okay, my answer. So what I can tell you is that it is interesting that I do see a number of people who do have a seasonal component and to their mood. And particularly what tends to track with having that seasonal component where the fall, days get shorter. And by the way, I don't know what it's like. Actually, it's totally different down in Texas. But up here in Baltimore, we lose 5 of 15 hours out of the day in the middle of winter. So, it is a third of the entire light that we lose in the mid-Atlantic. So it's not a small difference. It's a pretty big difference. And if those people are sensitive to it, it's not uncommon. Those people that tend to be sensitive to it have either recurrent depression, which it sort of has an undulating on-again, off-again course over time, or a type of bipolar disorder where they can, pop up above normal mood and get even hypomanic or manic, where they're revved up, full of energy, talking a mile a minute, doing impulsive things. Those types of mood disorders tend to be much more sensitive to light. I find that for women, it's not uncommon that if they have a menstrual variation in their mood, that they may be predisposed to having a seasonal impact. And the last thing I'll say is that it's certainly not everybody, and that if people notice that they tend to be sort of sensitive, that always the bad times when they look back tend to occur in the fall, and it often gets written off because fall is when people start school, and there's lots of excuses, but if it does tend to always be the fall and spring is always good, then light box therapy, there are treatments that involve light therapy, which is about 10 to 50 times stronger than the fluorescent lights in my office, and 20 to 30 minutes a day can really do the trick for those people who are sensitive to that.
Very, very interesting. Thank you for that. We're approaching the last 10 minutes or so of the podcast, and we've just had a couple questions come in live from Facebook. So I'm going to throw these out at you guys, see what you think. Are there any plans or current research happening to look into the value of psychotherapy, of talk therapy, for TM patients identified with depression?
So I can say that while we are continuing to attempt to describe the difficulties associated with TM, such as our cognitive dysfunction, mood-related changes, we have not yet turned the corner to really focus on our interventions, but that is what is rapidly coming up, and we realize that it's not enough just to describe the challenges. We really need to put our efforts toward looking at those interventions and outcomes associated with that. So I think that's really the next phase of things that will be coming, both relative to mood-related factors, but also cognitive functioning.
Mm-hmm.
I will just jump in and say that I am out of my depth when it comes to children, so I leave Dr. Harder to be the expert in that area and would, follow her lead in all of that. With respect to adults, the literature in general suggests that that talk therapy and medications are better than either one alone. And to say that there have been a couple of studies done, one jumps to mind in MS, where they used cognitive behavioral therapy and showed, interestingly enough, that not only did it help reduce the level of depression that individuals had, but when the patients with MS were treated with cognitive behavioral therapy, those whose depressions improved showed a remarkable quieting down of their immune system, suggesting that depression's bad, and any way you can get it better, be it talk therapy or medications or both, is a good thing.
That's very helpful, very interesting. And then kind of the final thoughts here, there are some questions that I think, going back to this kind of new concept in the field, you know, you, Dr. Kaplan, Dr. Harder, are leading the way in describing cognitive dysfunction and mood disorder in transverse myelitis and neuromyelitis optica, these what have been thought of as non-brain-based diseases. But obviously there are issues with cognition and mood, but there are a lot of providers and practitioners out there do not know this and are not aware of it or don't think that it exists. And so what advice would you all give someone who might be seeking, say, disability insurance because of cognitive issues from their TM or NMO, but their referring provider doesn't believe that it could be from their TM or NMO? And then how do you go about finding a neuropsychologist who's knowledgeable about TM and these kinds of problems?
So I just wanted to also add, because Dr. Harder must get this all the time, just add to that question, what do you do if it's your kid who's not getting any accommodation in school? So not only adults with disability, but kids with school, what do you do, Dr. Harder?
All right. Well, this is a fantastic question. And please prompt me if I'm not answering all the component parts to the question. So fortunately, you know, our literature is emerging in this area, and that is a place I would point providers and other folks to sort of see, quote, proof that there are, say, cognitive problems or mood symptoms associated with TM in many cases. And as I've kind of emphasized before, everyone is different. And so I think it's important that folks are undergoing these individualized evaluations in order to look at their particular picture. And I know that those things are taken into account, particularly addressing what Dr. Kaplan added, particularly for schools. And so we routinely work with schools and share our reports and evaluations and recommendations to make sure that the kids that we're seeing are having their unique needs addressed in a classroom setting. There are laws that protect individuals with disability inside and outside of an educational context. So there's a lot of information on that. We could do a separate podcast just devoted to that topic. So those are some places that I would start. And in terms of accessing someone, a neuropsychologist, the American Board for Professional Psychology, ABPP, has a website that does list board-certified neuropsychologists by geographic region. So I think that's a great place to start to look for someone. I would also encourage folks to speak to their physician, their providers locally, because very often those people are aware of a pediatric neuropsychologist or a specialist who could complete an evaluation like that. Oftentimes insurance providers will have a list as well. So those are a few different ways to access a neuropsychologist in your area. I think I've addressed most of the question there. I'm not sure, Dr. Kaplan, if you would add anything.
Well, the only thing I'd add is that we should clone you, and if we can't do that and spread you around the country, we should certainly, I would encourage the TMA to think about having an entire hour devoted to this issue of disability, both for kids and adults, and cognition, because it is a lengthy and complicated issue. But I'm just curious, Dr. Harder, for those people who don't live near UT Southwestern, is anything that you've mentioned and discussed in your research and findings, is that available to people outside of Texas?
Sure. Yeah, there are my colleagues are spread out actually all over the country and all over the world. I think a great place to start is a children's hospital. So if there's a children's hospital in your area, those places will frequently have pediatric neuropsychologists, pediatric psychologists who do a lot of the intervention work that we've been talking about. So I think that's a great place to begin.
I'm sorry, I was a little vague. What I meant is all of the research that you've done specifically in TM, is that available? Can people get their hands on that information to show their, you know, care providers and school?
Sure, I see. Sorry about that. Yes, actually, I would say that the TMA website does a great job at keeping that information up to date. We've done blog posts on these results, and then those have a link to more information. You could certainly Google this, and it would be pediatric TM and cognitive functioning, and very often the article will pop up through PubMed, and so you'd be able to see it there. But again, I find the TMA website to be the richest source of information, and I routinely direct families, patients, and other providers to that website to learn more information about these conditions we're talking about.
And I would echo that for mood and depression as well. The TMA is an invaluable and singularly organized and prolific source for this information.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can reiterate that as well. Not only about the issues that we've discussed today, but all of the disorders that the TMA advocates for and has great information to direct to family and friends and employers and anybody who would need to know this information and would be interested in knowing the information about the disease processes. And so we've come to the end of our podcast here, and I want to thank Dr. Kaplan and Dr. Harder very much for your time today and sharing your expertise with the community. And also a big thanks to Chugai Pharmaceuticals for their sponsorship of the podcast series here, the Ask the Expert podcast series. And hope everybody has a great week, and you should be hearing an announcement for next month's podcast coming up soon. So thanks again, Dr. Harder and Dr. Kaplan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.